This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. All investing involves risk.
Hello and welcome to another episode of L&G Talks Asset Management. I'm Nick Jardine, one of L&G's content managers. And today we've got a rather exciting lineup to talk us through what we might expect in the months ahead in private markets. I'm delighted to introduce our all-star group of Rob Martin, Global Head of Research and Investment Strategy at L&G, Lushan Sun, Head of Cross Asset Research at L&G, Bill Page, Head of Real Estate Research, and James Tyrrell, Research Analyst in L&G's research team. Together, this cohort will take us through the current picture of private markets and where we might be heading. So Rob, I think it makes sense to start with you. I have got two questions and we'll keep it broad. The first of which is, looking back on 2025, what were the key themes that emerged in private markets?
Morning, Mick. Good morning, everyone on the line. So I think I'll start by talking about investment performance. Actually, 2025 was a stronger year. Within private equity, we did see some stronger returns coming through. We're always a little bit bedeviled by the data, and we're still working off Q3 data, and we don't have the same kind of comprehensive indices that you get in the public markets. But we've got a good picture of what was going on. And actually, we did see an upswing in performance last year. Within private equity, that was particularly driven by venture capital, actually, which has had a very tough couple of years. That driven particularly by an upswing in AI and valuations around AI in some early stage companies. But we did also see an improvement in performance in some of the hard asset sectors, and particularly in real estate, where valuations are now increasingly bottoming out and income is coming back to the fore again and is starting to drive some stronger performance. So better investment returns last year. In terms of new allocations to private markets, actually these were down overall, but it was quite a mixed picture. So private equity flows down quite substantially, and actually the same for private credit. What we did see was an upswing, again, more on the hard asset side, a very strong year for infrastructure and a slightly stronger year for real estate as well, which has really seen a very sharp slowdown in flows. And then thinking more about the total portfolio view, one of the things that obviously is noticeable to everyone, but we noticed it, is the public markets were very strong last year. All world indices up, call it 20% last year. Whilst it was a better year for the private markets, it certainly wasn't as strong as that. And so for many asset owners, actually weightings last year will have come down. And so we are expecting a more active year for allocations in 2026. And that's likely to flow through into the transactional markets as well. Clearly, asset owners need to allocate capital, and then that capital needs to be deployed into the market. We're expecting to see more in both of those areas this year.
Great. So my second question is, looking ahead to 2026, what are our investment considerations?
So there's obviously stacks going on that we could talk about, but there's probably three areas that I'll pick out as themes that really pervade the whole of the private markets. And then obviously we'll dig into some more detail with Bill and with Lushan and with James. The first is geopolitical uncertainty, and that is not going away. And we talked about this a lot in the CIO outlook at the end of last year. One of the reactions to uncertainty is to hunker down and stick to your home markets. This, in our view, is exactly the wrong reaction at this point in time. We think it is really important for asset owners to be geographically diversified. And so we're expecting to see a lot of asset owners look at their portfolios in 2026 and make sure that their allocations are well diversified. And I think that's going to drive interest in complements to the US. It's one key theme. The second theme is around inflation. And we are seeing inflation start to come down, but there is no doubt that there is inflation risk. And we want to find assets and own assets that hedge that risk. And so we are looking for assets with pricing power that can raise revenues in an environment where inflation may well come back over the long term, or at least there is a risk that it does. And the third theme is around total returns as opposed to just income. Rates are still quite high. And if you look at the gap between yields on assets and rates, they're not as wide as they once were. So income alone is not enough to drive performance. You need capital growth as well. And so we are looking for areas which can generate performance over and above income. And we think value creation strategies are going to be very important this year as well. If you staple that to good sector calls, that's the ingredient for delivering outperformance.
You mentioned that we are going to dive into some of these sectors within private markets in a bit more detail, and we'll do that now. Bill, let's come to you, and we'll talk about real estate. I think I'm right in saying that expected returns broadly in the sector are okay, but not great on average. So my question is that given this environment, how can fund managers potentially deliver alpha for their investors?
Thanks, Nick. Yes, and really the answer to this question follows on from what Rob was saying. Expected returns for real estate in the UK and the US are around the 7% mark, slightly lower in Europe and Asia Pac, which in a long-term perspective are perfectly reasonable. So I wouldn't describe these as necessarily bad or average. They will deliver a reasonable return for investors. The problem we have and the problem allocators have at the moment is the strong performance we've had from equities, as Rob mentioned, and a desire from some investors to boost those returns north of 10%. Second thing I'd like to point out is we often talk in necessary shorthand around averages, whether that's the average return for the whole world or a region or even a country. And real life doesn't work like that. There's always a wide dispersion around quoted averages. But one thing that is slightly different in this upcoming cycle is that the dispersion of expected returns at the sector level in real estate, by which I mean offices, industrial, or retail, are somewhat coalescing compared to where they have been over the last 10 years. So very simplistically, 10 years ago, if a fund was overweight industrial, it probably would have outperformed. That is less clear this time around. So what does that mean? Simplistically, we can divide performance drivers into allocation, which is that sector decision-making, and selection. And for many investors, selection means choosing the assets. And I think in this market and this cycle, we need to go beyond that. Of course, the asset choice is incredibly important, but also we're seeing value in being far more forensic around location, even more so than we have been in the past. So what does that mean? Underwriting locations for particular types of real estate assets, but increasingly new ways of thinking about location. By way of an example, in the US and parts of continental Europe, that is climate risk, and the cost of insurance mitigation against that climate risk is starting to have an impact on performance. Also, in terms of income style, so by that I mean the type of income an investor would receive. So, give you a couple of examples. We can look at the spectrum of income from long income, so very safe investments, long-term inflation-linked leases, which we expect to do quite well given the repricing of that income style. But on the other end of the spectrum, we look at things like operational exposures, where an investor will remove the security of the lease and be exposed to the revenues of an individual building, which looks more exciting. We have to underwrite costs quite carefully, but it looks more exciting, and development as well. So we are coming out of a period of very low levels of development. That was caused by risk aversion, but also very high development costs. And for many locations and many sectors, there's a real delivery gap of the quality real estate that occupiers want. I think where we can make that work, there'll be a really good opportunity for above average returns.
So we're going to turn our attention to infrastructure now. This is quite a broad asset class, and readers of any of our material will know that one area we have a particular focus on is digital infrastructure. So we're talking about assets like data centers, fiber networks, transmission towers. James, this is your area of expertise, and inevitably when we talk about digital assets, the question of AI comes up. So I'm a fan of giving people what they want, and I'm wondering if you could talk about the influence AI has had on digital infrastructure assets to date, and how you anticipate it will impact these assets over the next 12 months or so.
Thanks, Nick. A nice, easy question then. Hopefully a whistle-stop tour will suffice. So when I think about AI and digital infrastructure, I break it down into the different asset types, as you say, data centers, towers, and fiber. And AI has really had the biggest impact on data centers. It's also providing some tailwinds to certain aspects of fiber for connecting those data centers together. But towers and residential fiber have been less affected so far. But data centers really are the sort of main character of this AI growth. And when we talk about data center demand and supply, we talk about power. We measure that in megawatts. And before AI came along, we were already in this environment where demand for data centers was driven by cloud demand. And then along came AI, and AI has this huge power demand. And so we then get cloud plus AI. And that created a huge demand surge at a time when supply was quite constrained. And we're in this environment now where supply continues to be constrained, demand continues to outpace supply. And that's led to strong rental growth and strong returns. And we're also seeing investors paying more for data center power capacity. AI has also led to sort of two new types of data centers. When you build these AI models, when you train them, that requires a lot of power in one place, ideally, but it's not a very time-sensitive process, so that can be more remote. And then you have inferencing using these models. You ask a model a question, it gives you an answer. This is a more time-sensitive process. So this needs to be closer to the end users, but doesn't need as much power as these big training data centers. Looking forward, we are seeing these AI models get better at providing their answers. And this ultimately could reduce the need for this proximity to end users for certain types of for inference applications. This huge demand surge for data centers has also come with a lot of new capital flows into the space. And in terms of the regional breakdown for that, we see the US taking a lot more of those capital flows rather than Europe. But we still see demands for AI sovereignty as being a driver of European demand. Given the capital needs for data centers are so significant, we still see big tech playing a role in that European build out in part by offering sovereign services. Now, thinking about, you know, what's 2026 going to look like with AI and digital infrastructure, it's always a very hard question to answer because ultimately the power needs of AI are constantly changing. You have software efficiencies, as demonstrated by DeepSeek. You have hardware efficiencies from new AI chips. And at the same time, the usage of AI is also increasing very quickly. And so this creates a lot of uncertainty on a long-term outlook. And so what does that mean for us as investors? Well, we should be balancing how much we're paying for the current operational capacity that is live and how much we're paying for those future cash flows that might be more AI linked and might be a little bit more uncertain. No conversation on this topic would be complete with at least a small nod to the AI bubble concerns. And in terms of 2026, I do see there will be greater scrutiny on profitability of AI. But the players who are best positioned to deal with that are those who have more control of what we call the vertical stack of AI, those who control and build the power, design the chips, build the data centers, build the models, and also have the applications. And the players who can create cost savings across that entire vertical stack might be best positioned to achieve profitability with these models. And these might also be the safest partners for data center developments. Obviously, AI certainly does create risk, and it's important to diversify against that. And that's one of the investors' best tools right now. So as I say, towers and residential fiber aren't so impacted by AI so far. So if you want to gain exposure to the digitalization megatrend, including AI, you may want to diversify your exposure across the different digital infrastructure asset types. And I'll end by saying that understanding digital infrastructure now isn't just about understanding AI and data centers. It's also about understanding power infrastructure. And one of the things that we are seeing is an increasing convergence between data centers and digital infrastructure and actually clean power infrastructure. Demands for AI and the power requires are rising. And that in a time of decarbonization needs to be met by clean power. So how can we match data center power with clean power generation? And we are seeing this convergence. And an example of this is a growing shift towards these regions with clean, stable, and cheaper power in Europe, such as in Iberia and in the Nordics. And we expect these areas to see continued interest through 2026. Whilst I could say much more, I'll leave it there. Thanks, Nick.
Thanks, James. And we'll move from one area that's faced some investor scrutiny to another. And Li Shan, we're turning to you last up, and we're going to delve into the world of private credit and private equity. And I think we're right in saying that we're going to focus on the former here. So private credit is an area that's been garnering a lot of attention over the last few months. Can you talk us through how you see the sector and how allocators can navigate the current market conditions here?
Of course, Nick. Yes, you're right. We've seen a lot of press coverage on private credit in Q4 of last year, and that's been continuing largely as a result of the First Brands bankruptcy, which actually had very little impact on private credit in reality. You've all heard me say this a few times before. It's really important for us to make the distinction between investment grade credit and sub-investment grade credit, private credit. So private credit is just like public credit. It's got those two components to it. And First Brands sits firmly in that high risk sub-investment grade space. So let's take the two different segments in turn. IG private credit actually had a record 2025 in terms of transaction volume, and we do expect 2026 to be a similarly busy year. Infrastructure and utilities have really been the main driver for that. And this really shares some of the same tailwinds that James mentioned earlier, things like AI, data centers, energy transition, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this part of the market has been incredibly resilient, really stable, given its high credit quality. Now, although spreads are very tight there, the high base rate means the yields are pretty attractive relative to long-term average. So, we've got high conviction for investment-grade private credit. Sub-investment grade private credit being a slightly different story. We did see a slowdown in activity over Q4 when there was a lot of noise about its risks. I actually think all that press coverage has been a really good thing for this asset class. I think it's made investors sit up and pay attention to their portfolio, look at the credit quality, look for cockroaches in inverted commas, and think about the underwriting standards and take a more selective approach to origination. We said at the time when, in Q4 when this was happening, that we don't think this asset class is experiencing systematic stress yet. And for now, the data agree with us. Default levels up to end of Q4 is still quite low. Returns are falling. Direct lending return over 2025 was about 9.8% versus 11% 2024. But the main driver for that has been lower rates and spreads rather than default losses. With yields right now at about 8 to 10%-ish for direct lending senior loans, it is certainly still pretty attractive to investors. Now, let's talk about risks. I see two main risks for this asset class in sub-investment grade private credit. The first one is impact higher for longer. Rob has already mentioned that. Inflation remains sticky, and this is limiting central banks' scope to cut rates aggressively. This is good for returns, high rates, high yields, that's good for investors. But for those highly levered borrowers struggling with debt costs as they are, this is only going to continue to be a challenge for them. The second risk is AI. In sub-investment grade private credit, a big chunk of the borrowers are in technology or technology adjacent sectors such as healthcare. And AI could potentially be a huge disruption for their business models. It's too early to predict what the impact might be. There will definitely be winners as well as losers, but it's definitely something in trend that we're keeping a close eye on. So what does this all mean for investors? I think private credit is becoming a more nuanced asset class. Dispersion is growing and underwriting discipline is going to be a really important differentiator. The headline yields are still pretty healthy, but investors need to be selective about how they deploy their capital and the measures they put in place to minimize their downside risk.
Thanks, Lucian. And we've come to the end now of what's been a very comprehensive and very efficient overview of what we see happening in private markets. I'd like to thank all of you for participating today. And Rob, maybe let's just turn to you for some concluding remarks.
Thanks, Nick. I think something that's come out from this is actually 2026 looks like a really interesting year, but it's definitely quite a complex environment. And I think it's an environment that is really going to reward expertise and getting into the detail. It is not simple. It is not easy. But I think for those people who are willing to engage with that, it's actually a really interesting environment from an investment perspective. So I must say, I feel optimistic about 2026.
Excellent. Well, thanks, Rob. Thanks, everyone.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. The views expressed in this podcast are those of L&G's Asset Management Division, as at the date of publication. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and we're not soliciting any action based on it. The information discusses general market, economic or political issues, or industry or sector trends. It does not constitute research or investment, legal or tax advice. It is not recommendation or advertisement to buy or sell securities or pursue a particular investment strategy. strategy. Assumptions, opinions, and estimates are provided for illustrative purposes only. There is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. No party shall have any right of action against LNG in relation to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Where this podcast contains third-party information, the accuracy or completeness of such information cannot be guaranteed, and we accept no responsibility or liability in respect of such information, not for distribution to any person in any jurisdiction where such distribution would be contrary to local law or regulations. Copyright 2025. Legal and General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Unless otherwise stated, references herein to LNG, we and us are meant to capture the global conglomerate that includes, in the European Economic Area, LGIM Managers Europe Limited, authorised and regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland as a UCITS management company pursuant to European Communities Undertaking for Collective Investment in Transferable Securities Regulations 2011 as amended, and as an Alternative Investment Fund Manager pursuant to the European Union Alternative Investment Fund Managers Regulations 2013 as amended. In the USA, Legal and General Investment Management America, Inc., a US SEC regulated investment advisor. In Japan, Legal and General Investment Management Japan, KK, a Japan FSA registered investment management company. In Hong Kong, issued by Legal and General Investment Management Asia Limited, which is licensed by the Securities and Futures Commission. And in Singapore, issued by LGIM Singapore Pte Limited, company registration number 20223187 6W, which is regulated by the Monetary Authority of Singapore. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on LinkedIn or on our website.